Hi, thanks for listening to one of our Sunday talks from the Center for Spiritual Living in Midtown Atlanta. If this is your first time listening to one of our talks, we certainly hope you enjoy it. But if you're a regular listener to our podcast, we would like you to consider contributing to our center. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go on our website, and it's easy to find the button and make a contribution. That will allow us to continue bringing these talks to you on a regular basis in the future. Once again, thanks for listening.
Happy Father's Day. How many fathers do we have here? Raise your hand. Congratulations to all of you. How many people here had a father at one point or still do? Okay, good. I got the right topic for today then. I think it's relevant to everybody. Putting together a Mother's Day talk is pretty easy because mothers are on a spectrum about this wide. You know, they all have their own different personalities and we all have different relationships, but mothers all give us basically at some level the same amount of love and nurturing and guilt. You know, they're all the same at this little spectrum, but fathers are different. You know, fathers are on a spectrum about this wide. I've learned that, and I've talked to different people who have vastly different relationships with their father, fathers with different occupations, fathers who dealt with their lifestyles in different ways, all those kind of things. So it's always interesting to me when I do a Father's Day talk. I also recognize that there are people here that this is their first Father's Day without their father. And for you, I have a special place in my heart because I understand how difficult that is, even though I went through it many years ago. Recently, some of you know, my wife and I were living in two cities. We were living in Raleigh and here, back and forth, and we recently shut down the Raleigh operation. We are back at Atlanta full-time, which is great. So we're back here, yes. Thank you. And the hard part was absorbing everything back into the house from the other house. You know, it's kind of like a snake swallowing a pig. You keep on bringing it in a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, trip to Goodwill, this storage, this kind of thing. And rearranging pictures. We've got a lot of artwork, not just the artwork on the walls, but we have family pictures all over the house, as I'm sure some of you do. And in my case, now it's different. In her pictures, they're color. In mine, they're black and white, you know, going back. Those black and white pictures from the 50s, you remember some of those? Those of you who are friends on Facebook with me, I posted one this week. Go take a look at it. And even though my father moved on to the next life, transitioned, passed away, whatever word you want to use, quite a few years ago, I was still amazed by the thoughts and the emotions that these pictures brought up, looking at pictures that have been out on the dresser in different places that I haven't looked at in a while. Now, I got to tell you about a couple of them. In the earliest picture, the earliest one in terms of years, my day, I was about 2 years old. My father was fishing, sort of casting a line out into the water, either Lake Erie or the Detroit River, Michigan, where we were raised. John, you were talking about that the other day. And I was about 2, maybe 3 years old, and I was standing right next to him, looking the other way, completely the other way, completely disinterested in what he was doing, which is fishing, which makes perfect sense because throughout my entire life, even though he loved fishing, I hated it. Okay? Never had any interest, never did, still don't. I don't mind drinking beer in a boat while somebody else is fishing. That's perfectly fine. But I didn't need some stupid fish showing me he was smarter than I was, so I never got into it. Okay? Now, in another picture, this is the one I put up on Facebook, we were standing in front of a house that we had rented, and my dad was wearing his navy whites. He was probably, I think I figured out, he was 32 years old. You know, the navy whites with the loose black tie and the flap on the back and the round hat, and he's really proud, and he's got his hand on my shoulder, and there I am standing next to my father in a two-piece suit with a T-shirt with my hand in my pocket, sort of like this. This was 60 years ago. Things don't change much, okay? And there I was wondering how long I was going to have to stand there because I was not a patient kid. Once again, some things do not change. Now, there were other pictures, some I went through, but as I looked at them, one of the things that struck me, and some of you can identify this, is how different my father and I were from one another. I mean, my father was about 5'8", 5'9", broad shoulders, black hair, dark brown eyes. He never went to college. In fact, I'm not even sure he finished high school before he went in the Navy. He didn't like to read very much except the local newspaper, which he read every day, and he had absolutely no interest at all in academic or philosophical discussions, which I've enjoyed since I was about 4 years old wearing that suit. Okay? So by the time I hit high school, we got along just fine, but we didn't talk much. But my father was smart. Okay, he was sort of what you call street smart. Everybody familiar with that? He could look at a few pieces of wood and a couple of nails, sort of look at a tree in the backyard, and by the very next day, we had this fabulous tree house out there for his kids, okay? He could fix anything, cars, furniture, appliances, all these kind of things, whatever you wanted. He'd pick it up and sort of turn it in his hands, or he'd walk around it if it was too big to pick up. And he'd sort of think a little bit, and then he'd take it apart completely and put it back together again with no pieces left over, which always impressed me, okay, that he could do that, okay? I was always amazed, not just that he could do it, but because that stuff bored me to tears. Absolutely bored me to tears. At the time, as I got into high school, I was into school and sports and student council and all those kind of things, and reading every book I could get my hands on, all at home and then at the library, so we didn't have a lot in common. But I loved my father very much, and I respected him, and I knew throughout my life, every moment, that he loved me. And considering how many people I know now who didn't have a father around when they were growing up, maybe some of you, or didn't have a good relationship with their father, which also may include some of you, I consider myself pretty lucky. So I do want to say publicly, and my mother will be listening to this online, I have no doubt she does, that I did not realize how much I would miss him after he was gone. 28 years ago, he passed. But the good news is, I'm starting to remember, even now, after all these years, a lot more of the things that he said to me, and a lot of the special things he did for me when I was young, which is always nice to do on Father's Day. And 2 days ago would have been his 92nd birthday. So June 13th meant sometimes his birthday was on Father's Day, sometimes his birthday was on Friday the 13th, and a couple times it was on both, which was really kind of cool. For example, if you'll indulge me for a couple minutes. When I was 10 years old, I was very big into baseball. I played Little League. I wore my baseball hat everywhere, except in church, where they said it was a sin to wear a baseball hat at the time. I think that's changed since then. I slept with my baseball glove. I was a Washington Senators fan. We were living in D.C. at the time, and I was big on that. That's back when the Braves were still in Milwaukee, if you remember that long ago. At one point, I had over 4,000 baseball cards. Okay, pretty impressive, all right. And sometimes my dad would play catch with me when he came home from work. He liked me being in sports. But after 20 minutes or so, he'd been working all day, and bless his heart, he started to get tired. So he did as he always did. I was just getting warmed up, and he was getting tired, so he came up with a solution. First thing, it took him about a month, but he made a net. He made a net about 8 or 10 feet, made it by hand. He learned it growing up in a boatyard and being in the Navy. Okay, he could do anything. And then he sliced up an old tire, so he had these 1-inch wide tubes, you know, or rings of rubber, and he fastened these rubber rings to the four corners and the four edges of the net. You got the picture, what it looks like? Then he fastened it across the opening, the door of the garage. Kind of cool, okay? And then he painted a strike zone in the middle, and the silhouette of a batter, and then he, with chalk and stuff on the driveway, did that the right distance for Little League pitching, whatever, so I could stand up there and pitch the ball. It would bounce off the rubberized net and come back bouncing, and I could practice fielding it. Okay? Pretty cool. Meanwhile, you can buy these things at Walmart now, made in China. You know, all my friends wanted one, but back then it was pretty cool. It was very, very unique. And as a special bonus, he could sit in a lawn chair and drink a beer while he watched me, okay, which was really pretty good. Everybody was happy. Now, another time, funny the stories that stick in your mind. I went to one of our neighbors' house to mow their lawn. That's how I made my spending money. I'd get $1.75 for mowing somebody's lawn at the time. This was back in the 50s and early 60s. And the people whose yard I was mowing were gone for the day, so I had also agreed to walk their dog, who was a house dog, on a leash. Okay, so I got to the house, and I opened the door. They had left a key for me under the mat. And as I opened the door, the dog shot out between my legs and was going up the street before I could turn around. Well, there was nothing I could do, so I figured, well, I'll just go ahead and mow the lawn, and I'll get him on the leash later, wherever I put that leash. So I started mowing the lawn, and 5 minutes later, I ran over the leash with the lawnmower, and the lawnmower ground to a stop and the dog was nowhere in sight. So what did I do? I went inside, and I dialed the phone. Remember, no cell phones. This was back in the dial phone era, and I called my dad. And he showed up 15, 20 minutes later. We lived about two blocks away with a couple of McDonald's hamburgers in the wrappers. McDonald's was pretty new back then. And he went and laid those out, opened them, and put them at the bottom of the driveway, all right? And he came up, he pulled a wrench out of his pocket, he flipped the mower over with a few twists, he took the blade off, the leash just fell off, he put the blade back on, flipped it over, and by that time, the dog was at the end of the driveway eating the McDonald's hamburgers, okay? So he went over and petted him, and he put the leash on him, and he put the dog back in the house, and then he waved, and he went on home, and I was back in business. That fast, okay? Very impressive. Now, I have to admit that it was nice having someone like my father to depend upon when I was growing up. No matter how badly I screwed things up, and I did, no matter what kind of problem I had created by trying to beat the system, which I did a lot, tried to beat it, not necessarily beat it, okay? Or whenever I tried to get away with something that I should have been doing in the first place, he could always straighten it out. He was like the safety net that was under me no matter what I did. Now, don't get me wrong, okay? And my mom would be listening to this going, wait a minute, that isn't everything, okay? He was not a saint. He had quite a temper, and he lost it now and then. But if he lost his temper at me, it was always because I deserved it. Now, I got smacked on occasion, and the older I got, the harder I got smacked. Back in my generation, some of you, that's what happened. Or when I got in high school, I'd get grounded for the weekend. But I never thought of questioning whether or not he knew what he was talking about. Because if my old man said it, you could believe it. You could take it to the bank. I knew that, and so did everybody else who knew him. You could always depend on him to do whatever he promised to do. Anyway, as I thought about it the other day, that's kind of the relationship that a lot of us would like to have with God. Wouldn't we? In a way? Oh, the spiritual stuff. Here we go. We're getting to us. Most of us are pretty clear that God is not a father in the human sense of the word, but sometimes it'd be nice to have this cosmic sugar daddy sort of keeping an eye on us. You know, wouldn't that be nice? Keeping an eye, protecting us. Maybe slipping us a few bucks, you know, if we needed it, you know, a little bit here and there. There is something very safe and secure and protective about that kind of God always watching over us and protecting us. In fact, that is why this whole God the Father thing has held on for so many years in the more traditional religions. Just like the perfect human father, the assumption is, with the more traditional religions, that God is supposed to protect us, that God is supposed to love us, however that is shown, and teach us things, and be there when we run into problems that we can't handle. That's the assumption. If we've got questions, we have been told, God is the one, He is the one who has all the answers. Now, it's also traditionally been the father's role to discipline us when we misbehave. Does anyone here remember in your past hearing the phrase, just wait till your father gets home? Anybody remember that? My mother was also very, very smart, and she figured out early on, we had five kids, that if she said that to one of us about 9 o'clock in the morning, we would be so worried that we would behave for the rest of the day. So she knew how to use that. Now, it's interesting how often the image of God that we develop as children and carry into adulthood, which we do, is a perfect reflection of our attitude towards the person or persons who fulfilled the so-called father role in our life. Maybe it wasn't our biological father, maybe it was a grandfather, an uncle, could even have been our mother. It seems that children who were raised by a strict authoritarian parent often have an image of a God who is very strict and judgmental and maybe even angry all the time, just like their dad. While on the other hand, you can tell the children who are really, really loved and nurtured, because children raised in a loving and supportive and nurturing family seem to find it much easier to believe in a loving and supportive God. Now, the same thing holds true as we get older. I sometimes think that our view of the world that we have doesn't depend upon the God that we believe in. I think the God that we choose to believe in Whether or not our choice is a conscious one is a reflection of what we have learned to believe about the world, very much like Ursula was talking about in her talk. So, and most especially, it is a reflection of what we have come to believe about ourselves and our particular place in the world. For example, if we believe that the world is a dangerous place, I know a lot of people who believe that, where we always have to protect ourselves and protect our money and our property and looking out for who you can trust and who you can't. If that's the kind of world we believe in, then we probably tend to believe in a God who is always testing us, throwing challenges at us, or maybe even a God who doesn't particularly care about us. Or if we believe that it's perfectly normal for us and other people to be sick or poor or afraid, that must mean we also believe in a God who allows those things to happen to people like us. You see where I'm going? It makes sense. The point is, and this comes directly to this teaching, unless we make a conscious effort, what kind of an effort? A conscious effort, okay, at some later point in our life to discover and to understand two different things, to discover and to understand the spiritual truth about ourselves, which is actually the spiritual truth about every person everywhere, unless we do this consciously, it is possible for us to go through our entire life believing about ourselves what we learned at an early age from our parents, our teachers, our ministers, our priests, our rabbis, etc., etc., and all the other authority figures that we listened to so carefully before we got old enough or smart enough to know something better. We need to recognize that the beliefs that we hold about our own characteristics and our own abilities, about how smart or how dumb we believe we are, about how talented or incompetent we believe we are, about how attractive or ugly we think we are, or how lovable or unlovable we are learned beliefs. They are learned beliefs. And we learn them, for better or for worse, by listening to people that we admire and respect, by listening to people who have a lot of credibility, like our father or our mother. You see, as we are growing up, as our mind and our...
You see, as we're growing up, as our mind and our personality are developing, we gather beliefs about ourselves and accept those beliefs as the way we really are. That's why if your father tells you as a child that you're not very smart, or if your mother tells you you're not very pretty, it can take a long time to figure out that these are their misguided opinions rather than statements of truth. Like it or not, when we're very young, our parents and other authority figures are like gods to us. They know everything. They can do anything. They're 10 feet tall and bulletproof. We can't conceive of ever being as smart as they are. And as a result, when they say something to us, we don't think of questioning it. We accept it as the truth, and we begin to live from that premise. The sad thing is, it doesn't matter if it's actually true or not. As long as we accept it as true for us, it becomes our truth. Let me say that again. It doesn't matter if it's actually true or not. As long as we accept it as true for us, it becomes our truth. That's why some people live their whole lives believing some really terrible things about themselves that were never true, even in the beginning. That's why the image of God as a male parent figure became so difficult for many of us to accept. But even if the image we have of God is one of a gentle, loving father, sort of like Bill Cosby on the old Cosby Show, there's still a danger in seeing God as separate from us. There's still a danger in seeing God as a being who makes its presence known in our world by doing things to us or for us, instead of as a power working through us and as us. Traditionally, at least in the Judeo-Christian Islamic philosophy, the religions that are called the people of the book, the blueprint for the image of God was the image of an all-knowing father with an iron fist. Now, maybe that iron fist was in a velvet glove, but it was still an iron fist, and he had a big list of rules. God was patterned after a male authority figure, which was difficult to accept for a lot of people, particularly women, and rightly so. I mean, so many things about it just didn't make sense, not the least of which was the idea of everyone being made in the image and likeness of God. I mean, when we started asking questions like that, the next question to come up was always, well, who was God's real image and likeness on earth? Was it Adam or was it Eve? In almost all metaphysical writing, including that of the Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism, the male image, or the male energy, if you will, was used to symbolize intellect and drive and forcefulness, while the female image, or the female energy, symbolized the nurturing power of emotion, sort of the passion of our feeling nature. But neither one of these energies is better than the other one. Both are essential in creating a healthy, whole, and complete person physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. The problem really is, much of the world has not yet learned how to balance these two different but necessary aspects of our spiritual slash human nature. A lot of us are overimpressed by intellect, and we're overwhelmed by emotions. We're more impressed by facts, by statistics, and by logical or analytical solutions, like the geeks in Silicon Valley, than we are by intuitive, thoughtful, inclusive solutions. We think that analytical is better than intuitive, but it really, really isn't. They're just both sides of the same coin, like that talk I gave a month or two ago about one coin, that's us, but our spiritual and human sides are the two sides of that coin. That's why for so many years the traditional image of God ended up being one where this big kahuna that runs the world is a know-it-all father figure who has all these complicated rules and a nasty temper. Even worse, many people have the belief that God is so extremely intelligent that we mere mortals have no possibility of ever comprehending it, so why even try? That's why so many people just blindly accept what they don't even try to understand. What many people fail to understand is that God is not really intelligent. Did you know that? God's not intelligent. God is intelligence itself. God is not some cosmic accountant or an engineer figuring things out and making rules and decisions. God is all knowledge and all awareness, spontaneously creating the world through spiritual laws of its own being, most of which are expressed through us. And, this is important, a lot of people don't realize this, even God is not smart enough or powerful enough to function outside of the laws that it has created out of itself. Or maybe even a better way of saying it is, Spirit knows, without question, that these laws are the way in which it creates this physical manifestation that we call the world. Now, assuming that, as perfect intelligence, God obviously must be working in the most intelligent way. I mean, that makes sense, right? Sure. So if God itself can't function outside of these laws, it's a pretty safe bet that we aren't going to have much luck if we try to go around them either. Because, you see, the same intelligence who is God is not something in us, and it's not who we are either. It is what we are. This intelligence is what we are, our body, our mind, everything. Everything. If we understand that, we can then understand that God is not this big mystery that's far too deep for us to ever comprehend. I mean, the truth is, the divine mind is not mysterious at all. It isn't mysterious at all. In fact, it is continually revealing itself to us openly and freely every day. That's what scientists are discovering in all the new discoveries about nature and the universe that they discover every day. All of the secrets of life, all of the secrets of the universe are all around us, all of them just waiting for us to recognize them so we can expand our level of understanding. That's what God does. That's the way this power works. So that means, if you think about it, what God knows, we can know. What God knows, we can know. Just like I grew up and learned how to do everything my own father could do and more, except making nets. I never figured that one out. I mean, nothing about God is hidden. Nothing about God is a secret. Nothing. Every great teacher, every great spiritual teacher who ever lived has told us this, even Jesus. He said, or at least we are told that he said, the Father in me is doing the work. The Father in me is doing the work. Now, when he said this, we have to realize this is a translation. He wasn't saying that he and God were special and different from all the rest of us. He was saying that we are all one with God. The same Father is in all of us. There's only one Father, and we are all its sons and daughters. Once again, speaking metaphorically. We all have the same masculine and spiritual energy within us, along with a powerful, intuitive, feminine nature that we, unfortunately, tend to ignore. There's a beautiful book I have in my library. I've had it for years. I love it. I've read it many times and taken information for talks. The book is called A Touch of Wonder by Arthur Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N. It may be out of print. I don't know. I haven't looked in a while. And he says this. Arthur Gordon says this in this book. He says, "A good father doesn't teach his children as much as he exposes them to life and living." Isn't that great? Let me say it again. A good father doesn't teach his children as much as he exposes them to life and living. And then he says, that way, lessons come so quietly and unobtrusively that often you aren't aware of them until you begin to think back. Until we begin to think back. That is really how life teaches us, at least if we pay attention and allow it to teach us. Now, I said earlier when I was telling my stories that I wish my father had taught me more. Well, that's not entirely true. The real truth is, I wish I had been paying more attention. I wish I had been paying more attention because every year, even now at my age, I realize more and more things that I learned from him that I didn't recognize at the time as valuable. For example, by showing me that it was possible for a family of six to drive 18 hours straight through from Michigan to Florida in a fully packed station wagon, only stopping for gas, I learned that motels and two-day trips are really a good thing. That's what I learned. I learned that when he was proud of me, like the time he cried when I got my diploma and my commission by graduating from the Air Force Academy, and he was crying, I learned that that was more important than getting a diploma. I learned from watching his life and by watching his death, which took almost 2 years, that how you live and how you love is important because you never know when it's going to end. And I learned that saying I love you and really meaning it when you say it was important because it just might be the last words you ever say to someone you love. I am deeply grateful. I thank my stars every day that those were the last words I said to my father. I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. You know, in one sense, we do have a spiritual father, one that provides for our growth and increases our ability to expand our life. But this so-called heavenly father, and I'm using that term metaphorically once again, doesn't control us. It responds to us. It doesn't punish us. It supports us. It provides for us, in fact, it has already provided for us, everything that we could ever need for anything we could ever want. This power, God, this Father, is the intelligence and the awareness of life inside of us, always opening itself to us. And if we are clear about what we want in life, this power will show us how to create whatever we desire easily and effortlessly. All we have to do is listen. All we have to do is listen. But when we do, the voice that we hear, that still small voice inside of us, won't be God's voice. And it won't even be our own Father's voice. It will be, you know whose voice? It'll be ours. It'll be our own. Because the true spiritual Father in us is just one special part of who and what we are. This is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine. And so it is.